and welcome to the Easy Button podcast that slices and dices its way onto your screen and into your ears. your co-presenters today are James Prendergast and
Taylor Boone. How y'all doing tonight?
I think we're doing all right, I think.
Are we doing good? Good.
Yeah, I think
we're doing pretty good.
Apart from that guy over there in the back, he's a bit funny. But I'm just ignoring him.
We always do.
We always do, yeah. Just throw him a bit of a slice of lemon or something. Right, so we haven't been on the air for a while now. Mainly my fault. let's have a quick look what we've got on today's show. So, obviously we're going to talk about our games as usual. I don't have any news. Don't know if you have any news to really talk about?
Nah, slow news couple of weeks. This is kind of the doldrums of the game season right now.
Yeah, I mean, we've got E3 coming up in a couple months' time. And so I think everyone's kind of holding their big news back for then, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. I think most everything is kind of waiting on that.
Yeah, I think it'll be an interesting year.
Yeah, I think there'll be a big torrent of news then. You know, I don't anticipate there to be anything very earth-shattering, but it could be a surprise, right? I mean, it'd be interesting to see. The one thing I'm really looking forward to E3 is people seeing some of these controllerless technologies more well-defined, perhaps?
Yeah, you mean Natal and the Sony One thing?
Yes. I, even though I really don't see how those will be used, I am interested in the technology, and perhaps somebody somewhere will have figured out how to make a good game that needs those things.
Yeah.
And so I am interested to see E3 from that perspective.
I don't know if you watched the Sony One controller demo thing they had online somewhere, and this guy is basically going through like all the three-dimensional maneuvers they can do. Like they use two ones in one one controller, where you to resize windows, move them backwards and forwards, and rotate them in three-dimensional space. And you can have videos on those. On like you can make a screen which you can move around on your screen in three-dimensional space, like in relative place to where you are as well. And you can have a video, you can have pictures and stuff like that. I thought that was pretty cool. And like, as an actual kind of future technology interface for proper computing, as in not a console game centric thing, I think that's quite exciting. But as you've just said then, you know, for actually controlling games, I don't think it's that useful.
Right. But again, I could be wrong, and there's a lot of smart people who are betting a lot of money, seemingly, on the success of this stuff. So
maybe they know
something that we don't know.
Yeah, but don't forget, I mean, so we're talking about, especially in Sony's case, we're talking about the company that released the PSP Go.
Well,
And then didn't release any games for it, or didn't have, you know, all the games that are available on the PSP Go.
Yeah, that seemed like a bad strategy. But do you think, again, I don't give these guys a whole lot of credit, really, but do you think both of these companies, who are betting in very similar sorts of technologies, are both wrong?
No, what I think it is when the bubble burst on the financial, whatever it was, financial markets a couple of years ago, they basically put their plans for the next generation of consoles on the shelf and they're to come up with something else. Maybe these were already in the pipeline for the next generation consoles anyway, these motion controllers.
Right.
But I just think this is like the stopgap measure. It's the only thing they could afford to do. They knew that, you know, not only would people not buy new consoles because they would be able to afford it, but also, you know, it's just too expensive to make the games on a what could be next generation console.
Well, perhaps. I mean, perhaps. It seems to me that, at least from my perspective, it looks like that these are direct answers to the Wiimote, but styled by these two companies.
In their own particular way.
In their own particular way. And you know, I mean, as far as the extended life of this console generation, if I remember correctly, I think it's always been both at least both of these guys, both Sony and Microsoft's, you know, stated position that this is going to be a longer console cycle than normal, or than we're used to, right? It's not a 3 to 5 year console cycle. It's going to be longer than that, and they spent more time on generating the infrastructure for both of those platforms.
I think they only really started saying that after that bubble burst. Like, they had said before that, you know, it would be a 10-year console. I mean, the PS2 and PS1 were 10-year consoles. That doesn't stop them from releasing a new console in the meantime.
No, that's true. That's true. It's hard to know what they really meant back when.
Because
the circumstances had to change quite a bit.
It's easy to extrapolate, isn't it, with your own kind of theories. Yeah.
Right.
I take what you're saying. I was going to say something else then. I forgot now what it was.
Well, it'll come back to you.
Never mind. Okay, let's move on. So let's go to the water cooler segments. So I just want to hear what you've been playing. Have you been playing anything interesting?
I have been playing some interesting things. Nothing new. Surprise there. I've been playing a bunch of old games that have recently gone on sale. Either on Steam or on our old friends, Good Old Games.
Oh, yeah.
The first one I've been spending some time with is a game that I've always been interested in, but have never found the time or the, you know, I guess the raw desire to go and spend more than, I guess, $2.50, because that's what I spent on it, on this game. And this game is Bully. From Rockstar Games.
Yeah, it's otherwise known as Carnus Carnum Edit or Edit in Europe, because they couldn't call it Bully.
Couldn't call it Bully.
Yeah, so, they had all the people like kicking off, all the soccer moms of Europe kicking off.
So, probably about 3 or 4 hours with it. It's really interesting. I like the game a lot in the sense that there's some interesting story-ish things going on. So I don't know. You know,
what's the style of the game? Is it like a typical kind of Grand Theft Auto open world, but set in school?
Yes.
It is like that.
It is exactly like that. So you have you're a new student in a private school, and you're given some degree of freedom to kind of roll around and do whatever it is you need to do. So you can go talk to people and get missions. You can go to class. You can beat people up a lot. People can beat you up. And, you know, so it's very much kind of a Grand Theft Auto-y sort of game, from that perspective. You start off with a tutorial, and at some point you get a clock. And so you have class, you have a morning class, and you have an afternoon class. And you can go, and they give you some sort of quick time-ish events that are not my favorite part of the game, because this is obviously a console game and not all that greatly ported to the PC. So it's not really all that fun to do some of the things that it asks you to do. But to get back to the original thing, or you can skip class and then you just have to worry about that. They have, these proctors that are roaming the grounds. If one of them sees you, they'll try to catch you. And if they catch you, then you go to the principal and you're a bad guy and you have to go to class anyway.
Okay. So you don't go like detention or anything.
At some point you get to go to detention, evidently, but I have not yet gone to detention yet.
Okay.
And you develop these relationships with your schoolmates, right? So there's girls in there, and you can interact with them, and evidently you get to kiss them at some point. So it's all kind of, it's not
social building kind of thing.
Yeah, so it's not heavy-handed like the Grand Theft Auto games have become. It's a little bit more lighthearted. There's still some kind of messed up stuff going on in there because, you know, again, there's a lot of bullying going on, and the fight sequences are a little bit
graphic.
Well, I don't want to say graphic because there's no blood or anything like that, but it is. Okay. But when you do when you have somebody down, you can kick them in the nuts, or kick them when they're, you know, if you're in the right position, or kick them when they're down. So it is a little bit much. I wouldn't definitely want my kids to play it, which is one thing that kind of hampers my play time because I only feel like I should play it when they're not awake and can see dad beating up little kids.
You don't want to get a reputation for that, do you?
No, not really. Not in this day and age, that's for sure. Not in any age, really, but definitely not in this day and age. But it is. It's fun. It's a fun game so far. And evidently, the world opens up for you as you go, and you can do more things, and you can get off the school grounds at some point and go into the town and do stuff. So just, you know, it's kind of like gated, like the Grand Theft Auto games, where you start off in one simple little spot, and at some point
you
jump through enough hoops, it opens up a little bit more. Yeah. So, yeah, but it's fun. I've been having a good time with that.
Cool. Where was that from?
That's from Steam. Steam had a $2.50 midday sale.
I don't think we had that over here. At least if we did it, I didn't see it.
You'd be at work.
Yeah.
I was at work, but I was able to see that it was going on in that bar.
Yeah, we don't have internet access to work.
Yeah, that's too bad. So barbaric. they want you to work when you're at work. Imagine that. I figured $2.50 is a game I'd kind of always been interested in. I'm like, sure, I can't really miss with that because I've already gotten $2.50 worth of enjoyment out of it, no doubt. And so if I never ever pick it up again, which I plan on,
you'd be happy.
I'm satisfied. And so the obligatory GOG section of the show.
I picked up Arcanum.
Did you really?
Yeah, I haven't played it though, but because you talked about it last time.
Yeah.
Time before, picked it up. And also picked up Master of Orion 1 and 2.
Yes, that's the next two games I wanted to talk about.
Yeah. So,
have you played those?
No, I haven't played any games.
Okay. Well, those two games are, they're just incredible. I mean, they're genre-defining games.
I mean, they're like just like 4X, they're kind of typical 4X games, aren't they?
They are, yes. If you look at the dictionary, you will see Mutu as the definition of a 4X game, because it is probably the pinnacle, certainly in my mind and a lot of other folks' minds, of the space 4X genre.
Mm. So what is... Because I remember last time you were saying that there is a difference between Mu 1 and Mu 2. And so what's the difference? Like, if I was going to play... Which one would I play first if I was new to the kind of genre or the series?
Well, you probably want to play Mu 2 because it has aged better. It's a more modern game by three or four years, maybe. But it has aged better. It's a little less hardcore about certain things than the original Master of Orion. You don't have to, there's some more depth there in Master of Orion 2, but it's not as fiddly, I guess. For example, in the first one, you had to worry about for every star system. So in Master of Orion 1, every star, you could only colonize the star, right? So basically, there's an abstraction of a solar system there. And you had to fiddle. There's when you click on a star, there's basically the things that you can do there, and you can. You know, there's a series of sliders that determine how you're spending your resources, right? BCs, I can't remember what BC stands for, but,
credits.
Sure. that sounds good. That's as good as anything I could come up with. but you can spend credits on research or on environment, and you always had to spend some money on your environment because even if you're on a Terran perfect human or a perfect planet for your species, because there's like, I don't know, eight species, eight races, you generate pollution and whatnot, and you have to spend some money to clean it up. Yes, so you spend some money on environment. And when you develop technologies, then you spend more to get to upgrade your planet, right? So that it generates more food, allows more population, which you intact, it gives you more BCs. So basically, for every one of these things, you had these all these fiddly sliders that you had to go mess with. In Master of Orion 2, a lot of that sort of thing has been abstracted away. And now in Master of Orion 2, you can build structures on planets. And first of all, each system has multiple planets that you can colonize. And then you build structures on the planets that improve the planet somehow, right? So if you want, for instance, better farming, that you can research hydroponic farms, and that gives you a plus to your ability to grow food on the planet, okay, which allows you to have more population.
So it's kind of like how GalCiv 2 went, or GalCiv 1 went later on.
Yes. So that's a good point. GalCiv 2 kind of simplified some things and added a little bit more depth in some ways to the GalCiv 1 formula. This is the exactly analogous to Mu 2 versus Mu 1.
Mu 1. Okay. That's interesting.
So, yeah. But both of those games, I mean, you know, I've spent hours, hundreds of hours on both of those games over my life. And being able to have those in a digital download format was great. I was very excited when that came out.
With no DRM as well. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And so I have a copy on my backed up, safety hard drive, so that if anything ever goes wrong, I always have it. So now I always have it, hopefully.
Yeah.
And then another game by the same developer, Simtex, was Master of Magic out. And that came on Good Old Games later in the week, and I picked that up as well.
I don't know that one. What's it about?
So Master of Magic is, let's see here, Civilization crossed with, Might and Magic 3, sort of.
So you have kind of like small squad style armies that have turn-based combat, is it?
Master of Magic. I was thinking more of the map, the overland map, and the ability to influence the map via magic. Have you ever played Age of Wonders?
I played Age of Empires.
Okay.
Don't know what Age of Wonders is.
All right, so think of Age of Empires with magic.
Yeah.
So you can cast spells, and your population is fantastical creatures, and you can put together stacks with heroes, and you can roam around and go conquer other people's cities. And basically the premise of the game is you're a wizard, and you control a territory, and there's other wizards out in the world that you're contending with for domination of the world. And there's some interesting things there. For one is you have the overland map, and then you have an underground map, right?
Yeah.
And so you can go into what's called Myror, I believe, M-Y-R-R-O-R, and you can fight on there. So you have multiple kind of planes, if you will, that allow you to give you more dimensionality to these maps.
Yeah.
So Master Band, and you get a lot of you have a lot of spells that you can cast to either influence fights or to change your environment. So it's not like a fully deformable environment like Age of Wonders is, but you do have some spells that can impact your surroundings or the surroundings of other, your other wizards.
Yeah.
And there's a really deep magic system there that relies on controlling nodes that have different elemental gems, I guess. That's how I always think of them, at least. And so it gives you, controlling those gem nodes, depending on which schools of magic you specialized in, becomes very strategic. So it's not one of these things where you have to control all the nodes, because some of the nodes aren't very useful to you or not useful to you at all.
Yeah.
And so it adds a great depth of strategy there. There's a lot of stuff there. And I was really, really happy when I saw that Good Old Games had put that out. Because that's a game I still have. It's one of those games that has a really awesome manual, and I still have it.
Normally they digitize it as well, don't they? And include it in the file.
Yes. You get a PDF of the manual and what else? You get the sound, and there's some desktop bitmaps that you get as well. Get the music. It's cool stuff. I mean, it's a really good game. I think it's $6. The interface hasn't aged very well. So again, if you're sensitive to those sorts of
foibles,
user interface / presentation sorts of things, it's probably not. I would suggest go pick up Age of Magic if this sort of thing. Age of Wonders if you're interested in this sort of game. But if you like, Empire Builders, but with a magical twist, you can do far, far worse than picking this up.
Yeah, well, that sounds good, yeah.
I mean, it is good. It's a good
game. How does combat work then? Is it like...
So it's a...
Do you send them into battle and it's also auto-resolved, or...?
I don't know if you can auto-resolve or not. I always play... It's an isometric battlefield, and it's turn-based. So you can cast spells that buff your units in your army to like do first strike, so you get the first strike in before other ones, or you can haste so you can cover the ground more quickly. And the battles are very nice and satisfying and tactical.
You know what is actually quite interesting about this? It sounds a little bit like I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's a DS game called Battles of Prince of Persia.
Okay.
And in that one, you build a deck of cards, kind of like a hybrid between like Yu-Gi-Oh or one of these other, these children's card deck fighting games.
Right.
And that, it sounds like a kind of amalgamation. Because you have your armies in a kind of isometric or top-down manner, and then you control when they move and attack and stuff. But you use cards to... Yeah, improve first strikes, or make them move faster, or whatever like that.
Huh. DS game, huh?
Yeah, it's a DS game. Got it. It's quite good. It's not for everyone, but...
Right. I'll pick that up. I'm trying to play my DS more, but I have so far been unsuccessful.
Yeah, what you need is like a phone adapter for the DS, and you'd be set.
Yeah. Then I could just carry that around instead of my iPhone. That would be cool. What else have I been playing? I've been playing more time with Distant Worlds. They just released a new patch. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what it does.
You can't see any improvements in the game?
Well, I've just put in a couple hours with it. So the general game is the same, but evidently they've tweaked some economic stuff that you're probably not going to see right off the bat.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And they made some of the AI more smart, more intelligent. About how it helps you build all this stuff. Because if you remember Distant Worlds, you delegate a lot of the gameplay to the AI. And evidently people have been reporting some issues, and this addresses that. So we'll see if it does. I just started a new game last night and played for a bit and started going. I have noticed that the pirates are a lot more aggressive in this patch than I remember them being in the past set of games that I've been playing.
It's not necessarily a good thing.
No, well, it kind of is because before they would seem very passive. I mean, you find out where they are, and every so often one pirate ship would come out and crash your space lines. Now, multiple ships have come out, and they've been all over my stuff. And I'm a little hard, and early in the game, I'm a little hard pressed to. Keep all of my private sector stuff up and running the way it needs to be running because of the pirates, which is interesting because that really gives you a focus early in the game is you build a fleet and start chasing pirates down. So it's good. It's still a good game. We'll see how that patch really plays out over the next couple of weeks. And then finally, my last game, I bought it a long time ago. Well, I bought it when it was relatively new. I haven't really played it because it intimidates the hell out of me. Is Hearts of Iron 3.
Oh my god, yeah.
Yeah.
Hardcore.
Very much so. So Hearts of Iron 3 is a hardcore simulation of the time around World War II.
Yeah.
you can, it's by Paradox, who makes, you know, one game that gets a lot of mention on here, Europa Universalis 3.
Yeah.
And you can play any country. You start, you can, if you play the Grand Campaign, you start in 1936 and it goes till 1948. And you have just crazy levels of control over everything. For instance, if you want, you have to research improvements to your pistols. This is an example of how much minutiae there is in the game.
Yeah.
In order for your pistol, you know, for, you know, your, the pistols that are used by your armies to be upgraded. And armor for your tanks and treads for your tanks and engines for your tanks and guns for your tanks. And all this stuff makes, allows you to make better tanks.
And presumably you can research more than one thing at one time.
And you, yeah, you research more than one thing at one time, but your role is to prioritize things.
Okay.
So what are we going to research and what are our priorities and what do we need to really spend our time and resources on in order to be most effective?
Yeah.
And that's just research. And then there's, you know, the political diplomacy side of things. There's, you know, I haven't gotten to where I'm fighting anything yet. And I don't know if I will, but because it is, it's very deep end strategy game stuff.
So is it possible to win without fighting then?
Is it, I don't
is
think,
that kind of game?
I don't think it's possible to win without fighting. I think I think somebody's going to fight somebody somewhere. I think you could potentially take over and play Germany and not... You not start World War II, but World War II is going to start. From everything I've read, World War II is going to start. Somebody's going to start something.
Yeah.
And so you have to kind of be ready. You know, right now I'm playing, just to kind of get my feet wet, I'm playing Colombia.
Colombia.
So, so I don't have to worry about getting attacked or anything. I can just do some research and build some stuff and do some diplomacy and...
Yeah.
But yeah, there's all these systems in the game that are pretty incomprehensible, and the manual's not real helpful, and the tutorial is really not helpful, and so it is very, very hard to get into. But a lot of people have said a lot of good things about it, and so I want to try to get into it a bit before I decide that I have other things to do with my time. So, because the premise is interesting, and that level of detail is interesting to me intellectually.
Yeah, yeah.
But we'll see how the game hangs together.
Okay.
So, and then the normal Team Fortress 2, Left 4 Dead 2, blah, blah, blah.
Did you take part in that, there was an event playing people from Telltale Games?
No, I was not a member of that. They picked the team by random.
Okay.
So everybody who wanted to play, I think there ended up being 33 people who threw their hat in the ring.
Yeah.
And... they gave 3 slots to the people on the Gamers with Job conference call. And so Rabbit, Julian Murdoch, and Corey Banks. And
Elysium played, didn't he?
Yeah, and Sean Sands played. And then our friend Dimmer Switch from Gamers with Jobs, he played because he's the one who put it all together, so he got a reserve slot. So there's 33 dudes for... 8 slots, so not the greatest odds in the world. So yeah, so I ended up not being able to play. But yeah, they win, they won. I watched the they recorded a Source TV demo of the matches, it's good stuff to watch. See if people who really kind of, you know, it's not serious because none of these players are really that serious. But
no.
It's interesting to see a quote unquote serious match where people are really into it for the honor of their publishing company / and or game site.
Yeah. So, like, if you want to watch that, do you have to have the game to be able to watch that? Or
yeah, you have to have the game to be able to watch.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it's in game. It's everything's in game.
What a rubbish. Surely you think Valve would have like a TV system where you could watch matches without having to own the game?
You can create a demo and then export it as a movie, I believe.
But you wouldn't be able to switch between different views and stuff, would you?
No, because Because basically what it does is it records where everybody was at any given time, and then uses the game to, and assets in the game to render the game. Because when I was looking at it, I was skipping around a little bit in time, because like the first 30 minutes of it are people waiting for people to show up. And as you skip around, it'll like act like it's reloading the level, even if you skip like, if you skip 15 minutes, it's like reloads that level.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I noticed that when I was playing around with it a bit.
That's quite interesting. You'd think that Valve would do some kind of free-to-download source-based viewing platform where any source-based game could like kind of put the information into it. You have to download the the texture files and the map files and stuff. You wouldn't be able to play the game. Mm-hmm. But you'd be able to view any match that was in the source-based game. I think that would be a quite useful thing to have.
That'd be interesting. I think they're more interested in giving you the tools to generate a demo and then export it out as a movie file.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you can put, because there's tons and tons of stuff on YouTube, so obviously it's possible. But I think they're just more interested in that sort of thing than, because you can take, like I say, somebody who has a lot of time on their hands could take these demo files and generate an interesting, you know, sort of play-by-play, you know, demonstration of these matches and then export them out as a movie of some sort and then put them on YouTube or share them or whatever it is the kids are doing with movies these days, right?
Yeah, no, I just mean, if you're looking at because you go in Steam, and for a long time, I know they've just done this new layout. But for a long time now, they've had, in the library. Tools. So you got store, and you got library, and then there's games, media, tools, and downloads. And media has been pretty redundant since the beginning of Steam. I mean, okay, you can download some videos, but mostly nothing.
Yeah.
And it's like, why they even bother having that there? I'm not really sure. You know,
yeah, I agree.
Just seems like something maybe they might branch into later on.
It's most of their garbage trailer stuff from the store that you now when you go to the store and you go click on a game, you get to see that crap anyway, right?
I don't know.
It seems like that surprisingly for Steam, they don't seem like they understand that part of things, or maybe they do and they're working on it. But
well, yeah, I mean, they're really so big, aren't they? They kind of do so many things at the same time.
You know, but it seems like it'd be interesting to make Steam's your digital game platform download service. Why not add Netflix support? Although Netflix already kind of does that through the browser, but still try to make Steam a one stop shopping stop for all the crazy stuff you'd want to do on your PC.
Because you think about, I mean, okay, it's not that big in the West, but in Asia, all these people watching StarCraft matches.
Yeah.
You know, and imagine that functionality put into Steam for like Left 4 Dead matches or whatever, and people could add their own commentaries, and you could download the commentaries for the video and stuff like that, and it'd be kind of like a do-it-yourself. Like riff tracks or something.
Right. That'd be kind of cool.
I mean, obviously, there'd be a lot of crap, but, you know, some of it might be. And then if they added in functionality like being able to subscribe to channels, so the best channels you could subscribe to, and like a podcast or whatever, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like our podcast.
Yeah. In fact, I might email Gabe tonight, or maybe tomorrow morning, and I'm a bit more awake. Just say, you know, hey, we're here, you know. This is our idea, and we're willing to contribute some awesome content.
I think that would be awesome. And here's our cut.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't going to mention that off the bat, you know.
Oh, you don't leave with that.
No, I wouldn't leave with that. Okay. So I know Gabe doesn't really roll that way, does he? He's not about the pure money making. He does things for, you know, for the.
I don't know. I think he's about money making.
Oh no! I don't mean he's not about making money, but I mean he doesn't do stuff just to make money. Because if he did, then Steam would just be as bad as every other stupid company out there.
I disagree with you. I think they're doing this exactly what they need to do to make a lot of money. But I think the difference between them and most of these other services if Steam takes the long view and nobody else does. Steam will issue a little bit of money today in order to hook you a little deeper and get more money out of you tomorrow.
Yeah.
And so I think everything that they do, maybe not everything. Yeah, no, I'll go with that. Everything they do is around extracting dollars from your wallet, whether today or next year or at the Steam Christmas sale thing, right?
Yeah.
And that's the reason why they become the dominant PC platform for this sort of thing, right? For digital download.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I actually, sorry, I actually probably agree with you. It's just, it's just, such an obvious, such a opposite way of doing things to every other company ever, pretty much.
Yeah, you know, and again, that's why they're successful, and most of these other guys are marginally successful at best.
Or they'll be successful temporarily, and then not later on.
Right, because, you know, if you're going to take a long view, screwing people over is a bad long-term strategy, because people will take it in the short term, but in the long term, they will not. And so, again, capitalism will succeed.
Woo!
In the long run. And there's your philosophy for the day.
That's fine. I mean, you're on record now, so you can't go back on it ever again.
I've always said capitalism wins, man. It may not be perfect, and God knows it's not, but it's the best thing we've ever come up with as human beings.
Okay.
So there you go.
Yeah.
this deep message brought to you by...
You just lost any kind of socialist gamers that may have been listening to the podcast.
Well, if you disagree with my statement, write in at whatever our email address is.
Which Ivan says I'll get.
So there you go. So right in there.
Oh, I will set it up this week. I will get it set up. It'll be done and online. Okay. So I haven't really been playing. Have you got any more games?
No, that's it. That's it.
I mean,
I think that's plenty.
I finished off Fable 2, which...
Well, good.
Well, yeah, it was okay. And the ending didn't feel as much of a cop-out as I've heard other people say it was.
Right.
I don't know if you read that in other people's opinions. Like, they all got kind of, it's a big cop-out at the end of Fable 2. And just, it wasn't really that bad of a big deal. I mean, it didn't really bother me.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I don't know what it was, but this is the second time I played through it. Properly all the way through. But the game went really, really quickly. I think I finished it in about 6-7 hours.
Really?
The first time, I went around doing so much other stuff. It took me about, I don't know, maybe 25-30 just to get to the mid part of the game.
Wow.
And then once you've hit...
Wow, that's a big difference.
Yeah, and once you've hit like this kind of big bit where you have a big gap of like 10 years passes, basically, that's like the game is basically over. I thought it was going to be like kind of, that was the halfway point, so I thought there would be like another, you know, quite a large portion of the game after that. And it just isn't. And so I was a bit confused. Because Fable 1, by comparison, was quite a long game. There was a lot more,
right.
It felt like a larger area. And the thing that annoyed me, well, the thing that I disliked the most about Fable 2, which is probably not going to affect anyone else's view on the game, is the fact that the world map didn't make any sense to me because it wasn't connected up. There was no way of seeing where you were.
It wasn't like a contiguous.
No, it was like
area.
When you went to. When you went, you could like load between different zones. That's fine. That's normal kind of procedure in lots of games. But when you went to you could kind of warp to other areas, and in that warp screen, you could see the places' names, and there's like a little image on the right of the kind of zoomed in map. If you say you're looking at say the USA, and you were looking just at Florida, you know and you had the word Florida on the map, and that was like, but you wouldn't know where Florida was in relation to say Fort. What's that place called? I don't know. Say Utah instead.
Okay. So you would know that Florida was far to the southeast of Utah.
Yeah, but you'd know that it was just there. and you'd know it would take you a long time to travel there, because it'd tell you how long it would take to travel there. But it wouldn't. I never knew in relation to where anything was in the world. It was really confusing. Right. I don't like that kind of thing. I like to know where I am, where I'm going.
Well, especially in a role playing game like that, you want to have some sort of sense of locality, right? You want to have sense of place, and if you're just kind of warping around, that kind of kills a lot of the sense of place.
Yeah.
Right, because part of obviously sense of place is very contextual, right? Mm. If you want to know where this place is in relation to the other place, and if you don't have that sense, then you just know whatever little area you're in, you only know the context of that. You don't know the context of it in the larger sense,
like,
right?
Maybe like next to like some really bad area that's dragging it down, the economy down or something.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, normally in those kind of games, even when they give you the option of warping about, I tend to run backwards myself, like, you know, through the areas. But in Fable 2, I didn't know where I was going. You know, I wanted to go somewhere. I just thought, oh, I'll go and have like a little explore around this area instead. I'd be like, well, how do I get to there from here? I can't see on the map how I'd do that. So I'd end up just warping, and then I think I cut down a lot of game time, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
That's odd. I guess one of these days I should pick this up and play it. It's just not to see.
Yeah, it's not like a massively deep game. I don't know. I don't think you'd really enjoy it.
Oh, well, okay.
I mean, compared with the other games you tend to play, I don't know whether you...
I played probably three quarters of the first Fable on Xbox.
Okay.
Just more messing around. Because it wasn't very deep, I could play it. Pick it up and play hour here, hour there, every so often, and then come back to it and not really feel like I forgot anything.
Yeah.
Which is always a problem with these sorts of, with deeper RPG sort of, sort of game. But, I liked it okay. There's some things that were kind of dopey, but, in general, it was a decent enough game, but I did like, you know, one thing that you don't ever really get, and it sounds like the Fable 2 carries over, is one thing I really like about RPGs, which is why I love Western RPGs and don't care for Japanese RPGs, is exploration. I want to go and take my party and go explore stuff, and if I go somewhere where I'm not supposed to be, I deserve to die. And that's just part of exploration. You never know what's around the next corner, and you hope you saved before you did it. But, and that's one of the things I did not like that much about Dragon Age, which otherwise an excellent, excellent game, but there was no exploration.
Oh, so there's no, like, little things you could find accidentally and stuff?
Again, there's not a sense of locality, except for you have a grand map, but you click on locations to go to, and then your travel is abstracted away. And so you're not actually physically going from, the capital city to the mage's tower. You are clicking on two icons and you're waiting for a load screen, which is, I don't like that very much. I'd much rather go and travel and see stuff, see the sights, which is why I like Bethesda games for RPG games, because it's all about the exploration. The story sucks, usually. The people are boring, usually. But the exploration is always excellent.
Yeah. I guess.
So Fable 2.
Yeah, Fable 2. That's all done and dusted. Nothing else. Okay, so what I'll do, I'll take a quick break here. Listen to some music, chat a little bit, and then we'll come back and talk about our top of the week.
Break time.
Topic this week, I think I'll give you the honor of introducing the topic this week, since it's your topic.
Okay, so I've been thinking a lot about franchise reboots, and it seems like that there are a number of gaming franchises that have been rebooted recently. And what I'm talking about really in terms of reboot is I'm not talking about a direct sequel, right?
Yeah.
That's obviously not a reboot. But what I am allowing in my you know, semi-rigorous definition of a reboot is something like Fallout 3, which is a sequel of sorts, but is released a lot, you know, a long time from when the originals were released, and is in such a different style, it's a presentation from the originals as well.
Yeah, I mean, you could pretty much, before that was announced, you could pretty much presume that Fallout was a dead franchise, couldn't you?
Exactly. I mean, one of the lamentations amongst the hardcore for a long, long time was we want another Fallout.
Yeah.
And when Fallout 3 came out and we saw screenshots, and I was one of these people, I will admit, this isn't Fallout, sorry. Because Fallout is an isometric role-playing game, and what they were showing was a first-person shooter game.
Yeah.
Now, it turns out that Fallout 3 was an excellent game, had a lot of flaws, but it was overall an excellent game.
Yeah.
But really wanted to talk with you, Jim, about our thoughts on reboots, franchise reboots, and remakes. And an example like a remake is the recent Monkey Island remake. Escape from Monkey Island? Is that what it is?
Oh, no, the episodes thing, you mean.
Yeah. Well, no. So that's an interesting way to reboot the franchise as well. But also they released that game Tales. No, it wasn't Tales. It was the first Monkey Island game. They remade it using exactly the same game. It's just they upgraded the graphics.
Oh, it's just, yeah, it's the, you can switch back and forth between, can't you, between the different
games? Yeah.
It's, so that's, I don't know what it's called, but yeah, it's just basically Monkey Island. I'm doing it for Monkey Island 2 now as well, which I might actually guess, so I enjoyed the second one better.
But to me, those are remakes, right? Because Tomb Raider recently did that as well, right? They remade the game, but just upgraded the graphics.
I would disagree with you on the Monkey Island.
Okay.
I agree with you on Tomb Raider, because they it wasn't the same basic game, because it wasn't exactly the same. They used a different engine, different mechanics, and so the grappling hook and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
But with the Monkey Island, it's exactly the same game. They just spruced up the graphics a little bit. It's like effectively changing the resolution.
So I'm going to call that a remake, right? Because we took exactly the same game, and we remade it.
Yeah, I don't. Well,
you're not going to buy my terminology, semantics.
I don't reckon it's not for me. It's not remade enough. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, what would you call it then?
It's a upgrade. It's like a texture pack. You're in Oblivion. You know how Morrowind has all these fan-made texture packs?
Well, in Oblivion has them as well.
Do they? I haven't seen them. But I know that Morrowind does. It's basically the same basic game, all the mechanics are exactly the same, all the quests are the same, unless you add other ones in from the fans. But when you do these texture upgrades, it just makes it look better. And that to me isn't a remake, it's just improvements.
Okay. So it's an upgrade.
But I mean, you're dead right on the Tomb Raider front though. Because they didn't use the same assets, they completely made it from scratch.
Right. So that's definitely a remake.
Yeah. I don't know what to think about this. Yeah, because I don't know, because you said like what makes a good remake or reboot.
So would you consider, did you play Fallout 3?
It did, yeah. I enjoyed it.
Did you play the original Fallout?
I haven't really. But I've played other games in that genre, like, Baldur's Gate and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I have read a lot about Fallout, because people evangelize it quite a lot, don't they?
Yes, they do.
And my kind of gut feeling on remakes and reboots is that I'm fine if they change the genre, whatever, because it's like Star Trek.
Right.
You know, not every series of Star Trek is the same, but they're all good in their own way.
Okay. I don't know if I agree with that, but okay.
Okay, put my hand up. I enjoyed the one with the guy from Scott Bakula. What's it called?
Oh, you like that? Well, you like Enterprise?
I enjoyed that for what it was.
Okay.
But I think, I think for me, if it's going to be a reboot, if they're going to make it, I don't mind them doing the same genre. That's fine with me. Although they'd have to have fresh ideas and fresh faces and stuff like that. But I'm also fine with shifting the genre over to a different genre. And, mm-hmm. and like the Fallout one, I mean, it was obviously a different studio. Because I mean, that's the thing with games, isn't it? They're as much a function of the time of when they're released and developed as the people who developed them as well.
Right.
So you're never going to be able to recapture exactly what it was that went into the game in the first place. Possibly it's wise not to try. And so Bethesda, an actual thought they had in their head when they were making Fallout 3, was they just made basically their normal exploration game, but in the Fallout universe. And that's fine for me. I don't mind that. Because it's not denigrating the original's spirit. It's like a homage, more than anything. Right.
Yeah, and I think Fallout 3 was definitely an homage to the first, more than a real sequel.
Yeah,
which is what they tried to kind of portray it as.
Yeah,
but it was obvious that the tone in that game is a lot darker, and we live in darker times, sadly, than in the early 90s when the Fallouts were released, and. The first two had a lot more humor in them than Fallout 3, which really took itself really seriously.
And not even a good one. I think the problem with Bethesda, they're not very good storytellers.
No.
Or dialogue writers.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So any humor that's in that game, for the most part, is unintentional, I would suggest.
Yeah.
But there have been other reboots. Prince Persia, right? The latest Prince of Persia has been portrayed as a reboot of the franchise.
Oh, which one? The one that's coming out soon? Or the one that was out the other year?
The one that was just released. The one that was called Prince of Persia.
Okay. Well, because I followed that game quite closely.
Yeah, that's why I brought it up.
They didn't really... It wasn't a reboot. It was just that they changed the... Because they went as far as they could with the Sands of Time trilogy, and they couldn't add anything more onto it, which they have now done with this next game that's coming out. But ignoring that fact, they wanted to just like start with a new prince and with a new storyline.
Right.
It didn't, because if you look at all the other Sands of Time games, they've all got the sands. It's all about sand monsters and stuff. You can't get up. For some reason, they weren't able to get away from that. So I was perfectly happy with them doing something else and trying something new with the gameplay as well. But the new one that's coming out, the Forgotten Sands, that's tied in with the movie. That takes place in between the first and the second games of the Sands of Time trilogy.
Okay.
So it's going to be a bit interesting. Looks like a good game, but it's... more of a delayed sequel than perhaps like a reboot or a remake.
Okay.
I was thinking about, this, because you mentioned XCOM.
That's another one I was going to bring up. Yeah.
It's an interesting one for me because they've kept the names, but they're not even keeping the same universe. Because they've gone back to the 1950s. So they've done this thing because ever since Bioshock did it, it's been in vogue to have that kind of, I suppose Fallout 3 as well. Fallout 3 and Bioshock have that kind of vibe of idealized time periods,
right,
kind of permeating them. And I think that's what they're doing with XCOM as well from article I read today. I'm fine with that. I think it'll be a good game to play. I don't think it's really XCOM.
Yeah, it doesn't. Well, and I am. XCOM's probably one of my top three games of all time.
Yeah.
And so, putting on my fanboy hat for a little bit, that game, that reboot annoys the hell out of me. Because they've just taken the name.
Yeah.
And nothing else.
No spirit from it or anything.
And even the crappy XCOM sequels, like, I don't know, XCOM Enforcer, or I can't remember what the other ones are because I don't like them. at least they try to take some of the spirit from the original game, and try to, you know, do different things with it. And I guess one of my lines is, you know, making a crappy game is a sin, right? But at least if your heart's in the right place, if you're trying to remain true to the ethos of the franchise, you know, I'll forgive some of the errors, in your game. But if you take a much beloved franchise and you strip out all the things that make it much beloved, and then you cram something else into it.
Doesn't even have to be a loved franchise.
Yeah, that's true.
What they've done is like akin to taking Star Trek and making it into a Wild Western set in the 1960s. It's just like there's no link. Well, okay, the UFOs are attacking Earth. But there's no link beyond that.
Right.
I don't understand why they've used the name, because it's not like the console gamers who this is kind of be. Because it's going to be a console game primarily anyway.
Yeah.
They don't know what XCOM is.
Yes, and so the name doesn't have any cachet with the target audience. Yeah. And so, yeah, so why are they using it? So yes, again, this game feels like, and it may be a great game.
Yeah, I think it will be a good game.
You know, in 18 months when it comes out, I might be eating my hat on this, but right now it just feels like, hey, let's get a franchise that has some sort of recognition that we think it does, at least, and let's go build it. Something else and put that name on top of it. Yeah. And it looks like a cash in. And as a fan, can't stand that. I want you to cash it in on my memories. That's what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, I think from what I've read and what I've seen, it looks like it's going to be an interesting game. I think it will be a good game, but I don't know. I don't see the point of calling it XCOM. It just doesn't, apart from the fact that it's a flashy name. It's short, it's sweet, it has a purpose.
Right.
That's the only thing I can think of, but yeah.
But you could hope, you know, there's a lot of people out in Silicon Valley who make names all the time. You would think that they could make a short, sweet,
snappy
name, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Again, this is where I kind of put down some of the fan outrage for a lot of things because most of it's stupid and misguided, and mine is too. But again, they're treading on my memories.
Yeah.
By this. And that's, so I would suggest that this is not the way to to reboot a franchise, is to go take the guts out of it and put something else in and just take the name forward.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense really.
No, even Star Trek.
It's always the same kind of.
Tried to make it a little bit like Star Trek.
Oh, you mean the new film,
Yeah, the new film.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the design aesthetics are all the same. You have the same races. You have the same kind of themes. So you have Starfleet, and you have good versus bad. If they changed it into, I don't know, like a soap opera, or Melrose Place in 21900.
Yes.
You know, it's just complete.
It would feel like a cash in on a Star Trek name.
This was like.
So I would suggest that's a bad name. Now, where Fallout worked was it was pretty evident that the game designers and the developers felt some connection to the source material, and they tried in a lot of ways to try to, they tried to bring the spirit forward into into their first person 3D realization of it. I think they went a little bit bleaker than they should have, but that's a personal thing. But I think they, I think they did. Obviously, there was a lot of love for the source material that carried forward into the game, and so in that case, I forgave them for messing up one of my beloved franchises and enjoyed their game for what it was.
Yeah. So I don't even see the new XCOM as messing up the franchise because it doesn't affect the old games. The thing I'm fine with, as I said before, with genre offshoots. Because they tend to happen anyway, don't they? If a franchise is around for a long enough time, then you tend to get the FPSs offshoots, or you tend to get, you have in Star Trek, you have Klingon battle, whatever it was, first person adventure, and you have now, you know, as opposed to Bridge Commander or Elite Force, they have all these different offshoots.
I was just trying to draw an analogy to the Star Trek games that have ever been put out. There are very few good games. So,
the Star Trek ones. Right? We'll leave that aside for the time being.
I see what you're saying. So, in your view, this new XCOM is a genre offshoot.
Yeah. It would be if it kind of stuck a bit more true to its roots. I mean, I suppose the way you could possibly see it is it's like an alternate reality where the UFO is attacked sooner than they did in the original.
Right.
That's the only way I can really see how they're linked.
No, I don't know. I mean, like I say, maybe it'll be a great game and they'll draw that parallel somehow. Maybe,
yeah.
You know, but, man, I just, from what they put out now, what I've seen of it, it's just hard to see.
Yeah. I just want one last thought before we put this to bed. What have you, maybe your thoughts about this, I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
What remake, in what genre and what style would you like to see? Of like a franchise or a game or something like that, or a reboot even.
So I would like for there to be a reboot of Master of Orion. I would like to see it obviously in the same genre.
Yeah.
But I'd like to see just a graphical upgrade to the game and an upgrade to, you know, some of the artificial intelligence.
And I presume the UI as well.
UI as well. Yeah. Yeah. The presentation layer. I mean, that's a game that they had a sequel, Master of Orion 3. It was horrible, 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 horrible game. So obviously it's very difficult to get it right. Bringing forward something like that. But I would love to see, that game given, a modern facelift and modern artificial intelligence, and some modern sensibilities as well. I mean, the chances of that happening are vanishingly slim, but that's a game, man. If they made a Master of Orion reboot and just call it Master of Orion and made it a modern game. I mean, I would buy that in a second. I mean, they could name the price almost on that.
just send a private message to Brad Wardle.
I will, and hopefully that they're. I mean, you know, one thing to not get too far off topic, which I guess we are going to, is this Master of Magic game that was talking about before.
Yeah.
He, or Brad Wardell's company, Stardock,
yeah,
is putting out a sort of spiritual successor,
yes,
to that called Elemental, that, yeah, I'm very, very, very much anticipating later this year.
I followed it a little bit. I don't really know how it works, but yeah.
I mean, if you go read up a little bit on there, that's what that game describes. If you take that and time warp it back to 1993, then that's what Master of Magic is, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
And they have publicly said that they've taken a lot of inspiration from the Master of Magic game. And they wanted to make this game be Master of Magic, but they couldn't get all the rights holders to the name to agree to allow them to make that game. So they're making the game anyway and calling it something else.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting way to go about rebooting a franchise.
Were any of the founders or the people in Stardock, were they in, what was the studio?
Syntax.
Yeah, were any of them in there?
No.
Or are they from them? So. No.
Okay. I don't think so. I think this is just, this is an homage, I believe, to that game and that genre of games.
Okay.
But I think it's interesting that, if you can't get the franchise contractually to go ahead and make a spiritual successor and kind of, hijack, if you will, the vibe from the old franchise, even though you can't bring the name across. And realistically, Master of Magic is a meaningless name, except with old people anyway, these days.
Yeah.
Nobody's played a game. There are still people who play it, but, very few, and nobody's really heard of it. So Elemental will come out and it'll be an awesome remake of Master of Magic, and I'll be very happy. And then hopefully a lot of other people will buy it too. Hopefully it'll be a good game.
Well, don't get your hopes up too much, you know.
Well, I'm a gamer, right? I mean, part of it is you are hopeful, right? Even after being burned a million times, there's always the next one.
I'm completely hoped out. No hope left.
Oh, come on now. Don't be such a downer. To be fair,
I am hopeful over several games this year. The new Prince of Persia is going to be one of them.
Yeah.
I'm holding my breath on the new Zelda. I've not enjoyed the last two Zeldas on the DS. I think they've been the worst games in the Zelda franchise since CDI versions. Wow. Yeah, I really don't like the way when you're playing the game, your hand is covering the action. You can't see what's going on because you're playing with the stylus. I do not like playing like that.
Huh. Yeah, I can understand that.
And also don't like having to go around on a stupid boat or a stupid train.
Well, I hope, I'm hopeful. There's a handful of games that I'm very hopeful for this year as well. And I hope Elemental turns out to be okay. What franchise would you like to see rebooted, Jim?
I was actually going to say Zelda. I would love to see Zelda set to a steampunk setting.
Oh, wow, that would be interesting.
Do you know how Fable's gone towards a kind of industrial times?
Yeah.
I would love to have a Zelda game where it's like steampunk. So it's like electric style steampunk rather than, pure mechanical. And I think possibly a slight genre shift. Some more of a action puzzler, maybe.
Okay. I can see that. Because they've always been puzzlers, not action puzzlers in the truest sense of the word.
But they're more action-y than puzzlers, aren't they?
Right.
But they've always been, in the better games, there's always been a kind of meta puzzles that go throughout the game that take you a long time to figure out or to get to the end of. But in recent games, they haven't always been there.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, I hope so, too. That's a franchise that obviously I've never really played when they came out. But I've always watched and always kind of wanted to get into. But yeah, I haven't heard good things about the recent couple of releases. And so I've stayed away.
Yeah. And to be fair, a lot of my love for that kind of franchise comes from when I was younger anyway, as well.
Right.
You know, because I grew up with it. Like, you know how you talked in the past about Mario being having like a kind of a cachet with certain people who've grown up with it?
Right.
I grew up with Zelda.
Oh, and I don't know why this connected, but a game that a franchise that I would love to see rebooted and get back to its roots is Ultima. They just put out a new MMO for Ultima called Lord of Ultima.
Yeah.
Travesty. Sorry. Might be a good
really?
Game.
It looks really bad. Travesty.
Doesn't look that great.
All right.
Free online MMO. Yeah. Haven't heard good things about it. and that's probably not a good way to reboot the franchise.
No.
Because first of all, anybody who's going to play that sort of game, I can't anticipate that they're going to be Ultima fans.
The thing is, as well, there's going to be the competition in that area of like kind of high fantasy kind of thing. It's like, there's too many.
Yeah. I wish that they would come up, either make Ultima 3 or 4 again and do an update, a graphical update, or just make a new Ultima game in the same universe, but have a genre shift.
You know what? Right?
Make a Fallout. Make a Fallout-ish sort of
game. I suppose you
game.
Could, yeah. I was thinking, though, you know what would make a good Ultima? Pardon me, like a Japanese RPG-style game?
Oh, don't say that. Oh, man.
But you could see it, though, couldn't
my heart. You're breaking my heart.
You could see it, though, couldn't you? Like, you can go around the world. You can find side quests and stuff like that. You'd have your party. I know you don't tend to have parties in Ultima. You just normally yourself, isn't it?
No, it's always about parties.
Oh, is it? Well, no, not Ultima Online though. The original one.
No, Ultima Online was, that was obviously the first successful MMO. But yeah, the Ultimas that I'm talking about were, you're a dude, you go into this alternate, place.
Yeah.
and you pick up a party, and the party members throughout the franchise stayed alive most of the time. Most of them did, and you come back. You know, you pick up Shamino or Iolo and three, and you go back to four, and they're still there. You pick them up again, and five, you pick them up again, and and they got around by saying that time flows differently in the real world versus the in Ultima Land. But yeah, that game, you know, because the single player games ended on such a downer. Ultima 8 was horrible, horrible, horrible game. And that was the last game that, Lord British really had ultimate control over.
Okay.
And then Ultima 9 was, kind of a reimagining of it in a third person perspective. But it was just badly, badly put together. They totally took all the good things of Ultima and truncated them down into just a series of dungeon delvings. And so the franchise kind of ended on a very, very sour note. I would like to see somebody come back that really had a lot of respect for, you know, Ultima 4 through Ultima 7 and wanted to bring it back and and treat it with the love and respect that it deserves. I would pay a lot of money for that game too.
Cool.
So. Yeah, and I could go on all day. There's a lot of others, but I won't.
There is two that I would like to mention.
Okay.
Syndicate. I would love. I know they're making.
Yes.
Well, no, it's rumored they're making a reboot.
Yes.
But I would like a remake.
Yes. Just upgrade the graphics.
Yeah, and you know, modernize the gameplay a little bit as well.
Yeah. I thought you said that wasn't a remake.
What wasn't a remake?
If you just redid the graphics.
No. I mean, like in the new engine.
No, I'm
no, you evil person. Also one last one, XCOM. There's been so many clones over the years.
Yes.
But they're not never quite. There's always something missing.
Yes.
In whatever they've done to tweak the gameplay to make it their own, it's never quite. So I really liked one called UFO Aftermath. I think I've mentioned it before.
Yeah.
But that was like kind of real time. But then the sequels to that one were completely ridiculously stupidly hard.
Yeah.
And if you made a bad strategic choice in how you were developing your game, you would basically lose. There's only really one way to win.
Right.
It's not very friendly to anyone.
And I've thought a lot about XCOM since they've announced this reboot of this franchise, as well as, you know, the XCOM games have been coming up on sale quite a bit recently, so I've been given some currency recently. The thing about XCOM that everybody seems to miss is it's not really, well, I shouldn't say that. Actually, I'm going to change that. It's all about the real-time tactical combat, but they give you the strategic layer that sets up and gives meaning to that real-time tactical combat.
Yeah.
And every sequel that I've seen, right, whether spiritual or direct, has missed the boat on that, right? It's not just about the real-time tactical combat, right?
Yeah.
It's about the setup for the real-time tactical combat. So you have that strategic layer. You have the soldier gathering the soldiers and equipping the soldiers and doing research to support the weapons for the soldiers and making stuff for the soldiers.
Yeah.
So that you see this progression throughout the game where you start off, you have nothing and the aliens are much more powerful than you. And by the end of the game, you are able to go toe to toe with the worst of the aliens easily because you've had this progression throughout the game that you've done both in the strategic, you know how to play the game better, but because of the choices you made in the strategic game, you have that ability as well. And I've never seen anybody who's picked up on that.
You managed to get the right balance kind of thing.
Yeah, because either they make the real-time tactical combat way too hard, right?
Mm.
You know, Terror from the Deep, the direct sequel to XCOM was that way. The tactical combat was just brutally difficult. And most of the games beyond that have tended to focus more and more and more on the real-time tactical parts of it. I mean, not real-time, the turn-based tactical parts of the game, and not enough on giving those, what you do in that meaning in a larger world, in a larger sense, right?
Yeah.
And it just seems to be kind of crazy that nobody's, I don't know, I don't think I'm that smart, Jim. I don't know why anybody hasn't seen that, you know, you have this turn-based tactical combat game, but everything else outside of that is got to be good too and support that directly.
Yeah, because I mean, I thought, yeah, Aftermath for me came the closest to it of all the clones that I've played. Obviously, they did their own thing with the combat because it was like pausable real time, which I was I was fine with. I enjoyed that as well.
Sure.
And I, the squad members had personality as well. I mean, it was random personality.
Yeah.
But like the way when the voice actors actually had, it was crappy voice acting, but it was crappy in a good way.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly. I enjoyed that game as well. Yeah,
I've been playing one called UFO AI, which is like a kind of it's a freeware, I suppose open source game. And it's not bad. It's not finished yet. But it's just it's very slow flowing.
Okay.
I think over the last month or so, I've played about maybe 6-7 hours or something. And I'm not past the initial stages of the game. It's not going anywhere. It's like when you read breakdowns of developers talking about how they made the game and stuff like that. And sometimes they talk about pacing and stuff. They have to get the pacing just right so it's not a big massive spike near the beginning of the game. And then levels off, or it doesn't ramp up at all for a while. And this game so far is missing the boat on the pacing.
No, that's too bad.
Because there isn't any progression. It takes like 500 hours to make something. You have 10 engineers, and it may take like 500 hours to make something that's a little bit more complicated than bog standard stuff.
People, you know, all you game designers who are listening, you know, you got to realize that while that may be realistic, I guess, to have those sorts of time, you know, things take a lot of time. That's not fun for the player to have to spend that amount of time on anything. And if you want to say 500 hours, but the game goes by rather quickly. Then that's okay, I guess.
This is 500 game hours. Yeah, this isn't real hours.
Yeah, so 500 hours.
But even if you think about how many days is that? You can calculate it out. So it's like a month and a half or something, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, 500 divided by 24.
That's too much.
20. I might have done that wrong. It was 20 days apparently. But then 20 days in game time. Is an awfully long time as well. Do you get attacked by aliens and you're not producing anything in that time?
Right.
And you can buy stuff, but it's just not very good.
Well, so one of the things that XCOM did, it's 21 days almost. One of the things that XCOM did very well was you didn't get attacked that often in the early stages.
Yeah.
You never really got attacked that often, period. I mean, sometimes it got a little hairy, but really, you didn't get attacked that often, and part of it was because you're starting off your base was so limited in what it could see.
Yeah,
you know, and you only had one base, so you only saw UFOs that were relatively close to where you were. But on the other hand, it felt like that the tempo picked up over time as you were more capable. You could see more things, you could do more things because you had better capabilities, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like you're getting attacked every single day in XCOM. You set that thing to fast forward and, you know, let it go by, you know, a day at a time. And it seemed like it was going to attack per month just to keep things going. But, you know, sometimes you would only get that one attack per month. Right?
Oh, yeah. Like in someone's territory to defend them to justify your expenditure.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, cool. XCOM. I'd love to see a real XCOM that finally gets it right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think on that note, we'll finish up. So,
okay.
Yeah. So, it's been good talking to you.
Absolutely.
I hope all our faithful listeners have enjoyed listening to the show. And we'll see you again next time.
Good night, everybody. I hope you all have a good one. Yeah.